This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Stay tuned for a real story lover's version of this week's episode of The Spark, Martha Woodruff's conversation with biographer Kate Buford. But our feature story today is Jesse Nadler's deep look at the working conditions that many employees in the poultry industry face. It is a big industry, particularly in the Shenandoah Valley, and it operates at full tilt in the weeks leading up to Thanksgiving. And many workers and their advocates allege unsafe working conditions and denial of medical benefits for workers injured on the job. Do you know what went into the processing of the bird that your family will enjoy on Thanksgiving Day? That's coming up. But first, the city of Harrisonburg just finished celebrating its own two-day film festival on Friday. It was the 7th annual Super Great Film Festival. And safe to say, it's probably not like any other film event you've heard of. In case you missed it, WMRA's Emily Richardson Lorente talks to the two guys behind this event to learn what it's all about.
He goes to confession every week, even though he has nothing to confess. He is the least interesting man in the world.
It really is.
Yeah.
Think of great filmmaking duos, and Paul Summers and Tim Estep probably don't come to mind, but maybe they should. For 7 years now, they've been hosting the Super Great Film Festival in Harrisonburg.
Every year we get tons of emails, hey, can we submit our film? It's not really that type of festival.
That's Tim Estep, and he's right. It's not that type of festival, because all of the films that will screen over the course of the two-night-long event have been made specifically for Super Great.
That's the difference. We're giving people cameras and film, and they have about 3 months to create a film, and then they come and watch their film for the first time when it airs the night of the screening.
If you're thinking, wait, what? How can you make a film and not see it while you're making it? Good question. All of the movies shown at Super Great are shot on Super 8 film, which needs to be developed before you can watch it. Do you remember Super 8? It came out in the 60s for use in home video cameras. It's what filmmakers like Steven Spielberg and J.J. Abrams shot on when they were kids.
You know, it's a breath of fresh air in a digital world.
That's Paul Summers. Chat with him and Tim Estep for a few minutes, and it becomes pretty clear that they're both a little bit in love with Super 8 film.
The shot that you can get on Super 8 is absolutely astonishingly beautiful, and it looks like nothing else.
If you were going to say one word, I think dreamlike.
Back in 2010, Tim and Paul decided to harness that dreamlike quality by holding a film festival built around Super 8. Initially, they had to sell people on the idea.
But then, once you broke the cameras out, it was just kind of like, whoa, this is sick. What is this? And, you know, it looks like a pistol, and it has a pistol grip, and it just does all these things that are really, really unique.
And the films that are created with this 50-year-old technology tend to be pretty unique, too. Like an animation of a woman who seems to be eating her own head. Or movies about making toast, Bigfoot, even a mysterious hole in the ground.
Hey, down there!
The festival is open to anyone interested in making a film, though there is a $60 registration fee. But in return,
we provide the film cartridge. We provide the camera, get other people like helpers, actors, cinematographers, you know, whatever people need. If they want to make a film, we pretty much facilitate everything we can to make that possible for them.
Paul and Tim work hard to explain the process to participants, but there's one thing some filmmakers still seem to have trouble wrapping their heads around.
We'll sign people up for the film festival, and we'll get a call, and it's like, man, I'm looking at this camera, and I can't figure out how to review the footage that I've already shot. And it's like, well, unless you have a spare chemical bath, you're not going to be able to see it.
In fact, filmmakers send their undeveloped reels to Tim and Paul, who then send them off to California for processing. When the films come back, they're often rife with little mistakes. Actors dropping props, looking into the camera. Paul Summers calls these happy accidents.
You know, you see them in the theater and everybody, you know, encouragingly laughs, and it totally works.
But occasionally there are bigger problems, like the time one man's reel came back all black.
And we called him, and he was just made like this visceral kind of ugh, and was telling us how he had pushed a car off of a cliff and got it on film, and we were telling him that it was gone.
A far more common problem turns out to be length. Each filmmaker receives only one reel of Super 8 film, 200 seconds of footage, no more. And sometimes that runs out before they think it will.
There's been a lot of films that don't have a last shot. the punchline.
Audio turns out to be a big challenge, too. Filmmakers have to create their soundtracks separately from the visuals, without the benefit of seeing what they've shot. That makes lining up or syncing dialogue really difficult.
Because it comes out looking like a kung fu film.
Which gave one group of participants last year an idea.
I can end your life right now. That is, of course, unless you know kung fu. No, please!
And it was just like a 70s kung fu film with, you know, the fast zooms and the snappy cameras and overdubbed audio.
But even those filmmakers didn't know how their film had turned out before they screened it in front of an audience. Which is why, Paul and Tim say, the super great screenings are so fun and electric.
I think that's sort of the build-up that happens before the festival, and the buzz you feel in there is because, like, you have no idea.
For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson Lorente.
Now to today's feature story. As most of us turn our attention to Thanksgiving preparations this Thursday, WMRA's Jesse Nadler talks to workers inside the poultry industry of Rockingham County. Some of them allege breakneck processing speeds, unsafe conditions, and denial of benefits for injuries sustained, trying to bring cheap poultry to consumers.
Here's a Thanksgiving anecdote for you. A woman gets her hand slammed by a speeding 30-pound turkey. It sounds bizarre, but that's what Maria says happened to her while working on the line at one of the big poultry plants around Harrisonburg. Cargill, Pilgrim's Pride, Purdue, they're all here. I met with Maria and about 12 other poultry workers in a dim, windowless room at the back of a Hispanic grocery store in Harrisonburg.
A turkey hit me and knocked me over.
Maria's accident happened during the run-up to Thanksgiving last year when production increases from 35 turkeys per minute to 50. Think about that. Almost one turkey per second. Turkey. 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 Eviscerated whole birds hung from hooks travel quickly down an assembly line. Maria's job was to bag them.
Two came at once when I was trying to bag one, and they threw me down. My hand is everything.
Maria is from Central America. She didn't want to use her real name or mention the specific plant because she still works there. Injuries in the poultry industry are very common. The frenetic pace, cold, slippery conditions, and exposure to dangerous chemicals make it one of the most dangerous jobs there is, according to the U.S. government's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. Amputations and sickness are not uncommon. Rates of carpal tunnel resulting from repetitive motion are 7 times the national average. But it's what happens after a worker gets injured that is of most concern. In Maria's case, she reported the injury of her right hand to management.
Look, they sent me to the killing area to cut intestines. They bandaged my arm. And I worked with my other arm for 8 hours.
Cutting turkey parts with scissors using her left hand thousands and thousands of times a day caused a muscular disorder in that arm. Now both arms were injured.
Vete pa tu casa por 5 meses.
They sent me to the so-called nurse, and the so-called nurse said, no, you can't work like that. And they sent me home for 5 months. They didn't pay me a cent.
Maria eventually had to have surgery. She said the company paid zero workman's compensation. Maria had worked for this company for 7 years. Other workers in that room repeated very similar stories, which corresponds closely to findings in a recent report by the anti-poverty group Oxfam. And the general narrative goes like this. Worker gets hurt due to dangerous conditions. The company minimizes concerns. The worker goes right back to work for fear of being fired, gets re-injured. The company either reassigns the worker to another duty, fires them, or sends them home without pay or access to benefits.
This is an industry that has just gotten away with, I think, some of the lowest labor standards.
Deborah Berkowitz is a senior fellow for the National Employment Law Project and a former OSHA official.
The company's obligation under the state workers' compensation law is that they have to provide adequate medical care, they have to provide rehabilitation, and they, you know, have to provide lost wages to get the worker back to work. And that's clearly not even happening here.
I reached out to a few poultry processors in the area for comment. Because of the anonymous nature of the complaints, most processors chose not to respond, but Cargill emailed a statement saying the company, quote, complies with all regulations. We believe a safe workplace is paramount for people employed at our processing facility, unquote. The National Chicken Council highlights government statistics showing that rates of injury and illness in the poultry industry are at an all-time low.
These statistics are self-reported statistics by the industry to the government.
Berkowitz says companies have a history of underreporting injuries and limiting medical care to the level of first aid, bandages, aspirin, to avoid having to report it to OSHA. The workers themselves often don't realize what's going on.
I think the industry purposely locates and hires the most vulnerable workers. Workers that may not speak the language, and workers that clearly don't know their rights. For the industry, workers are expendable.
Harrisonburg is a big refugee resettlement city. Arriving Iraqis and El Salvadorians in need of work invariably find their way to one of the many poultry plants. It becomes a catch-22. Immigrants land badly needed jobs, but the jobs can be dangerous and exploitative. Annual turnover in factories can hit 100%. The poultry industry, meanwhile, is booming. Americans eat 100 pounds of poultry per person per year, more than any other protein. Four companies, Tyson, Pilgrim's Pride, Sanderson Farms, and Purdue, control the majority of the marketplace. A class action lawsuit has been filed accusing producers of artificially inflating the retail price of chicken. Poultry workers, they make between $8 and $12 an hour.
Consumers have made their voices heard about no antibiotics in the poultry feed. But consumers also need to be aware that workers are not treated humanely and they're not treated with dignity.
Berkowitz will be speaking at a poultry workers rally in downtown Harrisonburg on Tuesday, November 22nd. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. I met writer Kate Buford just after Knopf published her biography, Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe, which incidentally wasn't Kate's first biographical rodeo, as Knopf had also published her earlier work, Burt Lancaster and American Life. So when Kate Buford sent me a note mentioning she was putting her biographical chops to use in a new business venture, I asked her to please come on over from Charlottesville and talk about it.
The spark, the inspiration for this company, Biography by Design, was the last line of one of my, well, it is the great novel. I think there's Middlemarch and then there's everything else. And this is the last line of Middlemarch by George Eliot. And she says, but the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts. And that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs.
All right, when did you first read Middlemarch?
Oh, gosh. Probably when I was about 20, 22. I've read it at least two times since.
And when did this line jump out at you, and why did it?
Well, it's beautifully written, the cadence of it. It has a pace to it. So as a writer or as someone with words, the way that she paces it, it's a long sentence. That was all one sentence. And then it ends in the word tombs, which is a sonorous, definitive, deathly word. And I just thought there was that. There was the style. But then think of all the people we know and are related to, or are related to, who have changed our lives. And no one knows about them except immediate family. And yet they are precious to that group. And the goodness they've done has rippled out to so many different people. And their histories are not known.
Do you remember the moment when you were contemplating the last line of Middlemarch? And you said, there's a business there.
Yes, I remember it. And my partner, Abby Santamaria, had almost the same inspiration. I had, of course, as you know, I've written commercial biographies for Knopf on big, famous masculine men and in sports and in the movies.
Literary biography.
Literary biography. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and just because they sold well, does it mean?
Yeah, right. Well, Knopf is known for that. So these were the traditional cradle to grave, thoroughly researched, wonderful projects. Love them, love them, love them. But along the way, I also did a couple of private projects. And one of them was for Friends in Goochland. And he was one of the first Peace Corps volunteers. And when he was in Colombia in the early 60s, he took meticulous notes of the wonderful people he'd met. And he took his father's old Exacta camera down with him and took these really excellent photographs. And he'd kept all of that material. And he wanted a book about it. And the proceeds would go to the Peace Corps. So I helped him with that book. I wrote the chapter introductions. I organized the narrative, the structure of the story, how it was going to go, edited it, and pretty much did the book with his words on most of the sections, the anecdotal sections. And it was so satisfying to bring to life that story. And so by extension, I thought, and particularly about women, I thought, there are just so many stories. Everyone has a story.
Oh, I don't buy that at all.
No, no. I'm preaching to the choir here. But yeah, so from Middlemarch, which had always haunted me, this idea of this person whose effect of her being was incalculably diffusive, going out and out and out and out and out. And so by extension, I thought, all right, I really like doing these big commercial books. They're great. I can continue to do those. But on the side, I'd like to do more of this. I'd like to make people's personal histories come to life. So this company, Biography by Design, LLC, is designed to do private histories of people, individuals, couples, families, nonprofits, or a project, you know, a not-for-profit project. And how did it get dreamed up? Everything gets created because someone had an idea. And the challenge for the storyteller is to find that spark that started that idea. So that was the genesis. I start with the really core belief that every person has a story. Every person's life has a story. They may not look at it that way. That's why they often need help. They just think, well, I've lived it, as you say. One thing happened and then another thing and another thing. But every life also has themes, has objectives. And it's when you speak, when you then start the interview process, which is the first step, you talk to them, or they talk to me, and you listen really carefully, and you begin to see the narrative plot points. You begin to see what they probably can't see yet, is that, yes, they had a direction, or multiple directions, multiple things that were important to them, that they organized their life around, even if they weren't aware of it at the time. So all of these things come together and make a story. And you help get that out of them. It's their story, but they need to tell me.
And do you fact check?
Yes.
Or do you?
Yes.
Yes.
The context. For example, the book on the Peace Corps.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't fact check the actual stories about the people, but I could put in fact checked information about Colombia at that point in time, the Peace Corps at that point in time, the genesis of the Peace Corps, those sorts of things. Yes, would fact check.
Okay.
And you'd also check with other people in the family because you're telling a story your way. Well, now your sister or brother might say, well, that's not the way it happened. But that can be a caveat at the beginning.
Yes.
Where you say, look, every sibling has a different childhood. And this is my version of my childhood, for example.
What do you get out of this? I know it's an income stream, and I know you get to work with lovely associates,
mm-hmm.
but it's you and a computer and with a bunch of information putting a story together. What do you get out of it?
I get out of it, well, again, I'm always curious about people's lives, so I'm learning something all the time. There's this really deep satisfaction of getting someone to a point where they can see that their life does have a story and that it has chapters and themes, just like it really elevates the story without glorifying anything. It just sees the structure in the life. And One person from church the other day who had asked me to look over, she heard I was doing this. She said, oh, I need help. And she gave me what she'd written, this sort of manuscript. And I haven't even looked at it yet. But just talking to her, she then came up to me a week later and she said, now I know what I have to do. She said, I just gave her a couple of tips. And so now she's continuing the writing and just thrilled because she kind of got an approach to it that she didn't have before. And that means everything when people find that meaningful, when they find that their story has been dignified.
Kate Buford also has a third traditional biography of her own in the works.
It'll be really very different, not a cradle-to-grave biography at all. But if it works, I will be very happy.
And so. You will find time to do it how?
I don't know, Martha. I'll just stop sleeping or something.
Pictures and links are on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. This Thanksgiving, many Americans will sit down around a table, partake in a great feast, and perhaps finish it off with a slice of apple pie. As my scientific hero Carl Sagan used to say,
if you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
We are a carbon-based life form. We breathe oxygen, we have iron in our blood, and we live on a planet that has an atmosphere that is mostly nitrogen. Where does this stuff come from? We know that hydrogen, helium, and trace amounts of lithium were produced in the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang. Everything else on the periodic table was produced in stars that either exploded cataclysmically, dumping the innards of elements produced in the core, or from lower mass stars that shed its outer layers into interstellar space. The exploding material may cause a reservoir of gas and dust to collapse and form new stars. This new star is now seeded with the elements produced in the earlier generation of stars. Planets may form around these new stars enriched in this stuff, and life may develop on some of these planets enriched in this material. We know that this story has played out at least once in the history of the universe. You are literally made of stardust. For the John C. Wells Planetarium, I'm Chanel Varani.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Pam and Jim Huggins, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, and an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news, how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click Like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio, and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.